Just 4 weeks ago, the Midwest came alive with reports of unidentified flying objects. Scores of persons told of UFOs in an area of about 900 square miles in four states. The Air Force sent its chief investigator on UFOs, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, to find an answer. His answer came less than 2 days later.
They told me that it is characteristic of swamps to develop quite a bit of marsh gas. I can't prove that this is the case, but it seems to me a very likely explanation.
Rarely has an explanation been greeted with such hostility. Ann Arbor Sheriff Douglas Harvey said of Dr. Hynek,
"He's all wet. Last night he was in my office. He told me he had no idea what it was, but he said the Pentagon said that he had to make a statement tomorrow."
I'm Jim Nettleton, and this is WDRC's Hot Seat. Tonight and next week, UFOs, the mystery and the challenge. Confined to the territorial boundaries of these United States. As far back as 3000 B.C., people were seeing things in the sky they couldn't explain. Off and on through the centuries, reports of what we now call UFOs were made from every corner of the earth. During the past few years, the public has become increasingly interested in UFOs, and the amount of publicity given reports has been increasing proportionately. In recent months, no series of reports received greater notoriety than the week-long rash from the Midwest, and no series of reports was clouded in greater controversy. It all started March 8th in Chesterton, Indiana. A service station attendant and a customer watched an oblong UFO hover over them for about 4 minutes. They said it looked silver and had four projections on its top. That was Tuesday. By the weekend, UFOs were being reported in Indiana, Wisconsin, and Michigan. In Ann Arbor, Michigan, Washtenaw County Deputies Buford Bush Rowe and John Foster were riding in their patrol car March 14th in the early morning when they spotted a mysterious flying object maneuvering at about 10,000 feet. They followed the object, which was flashing bluish-green and red lights, toward the county line, where they reported it was joined by three similar objects. The two deputies radioed two other patrol cars occupied by four other officers who confirmed the number of objects and the type of maneuvers. All agreed that the maneuvers were taking place at tremendous speed. In the days that followed, scores of persons reported seeing similar objects doing similar things. In LaPorte, Indiana, Patrolman Michael Spevak saw a yellowish-white object with an X-shaped appendage like an antenna protruding from it. In Black River Falls, Wisconsin, several persons saw UFOs with bright green lights and heard a beeping sound. In Grand Rapids, Michigan, eight people reported a large oval UFO with a row of lights which made a humming sound. In Dexter, Michigan, police reported a disc-like object with lights, a rough surface, and antenna-like projections on the bottom. In Hillsdale, the civil defense director, the dean of a women's college, and 87 students reported an oval object which hovered and maneuvered for 3 hours. And there were many, many others. The following week, the Air Force decided to look into the sightings. Project Blue Book, the official Air Force investigative agency on unidentified flying objects, sent Dr. J. Allen Hynek, its chief civilian consultant on UFOs, to probe the affair. Dr. Hynek is chairman of the Department of Astronomy at Northwestern University. On Friday, March 25th, Dr. Hynek reported his findings. I spoke with him shortly after his public report And he elaborated further.
The Michigan sightings were not, in my opinion, entirely representative cases. These two cases, I think, have a natural explanation. They both occurred in a swampy area. Of the many people who reported the sightings, only two reported any object connected with it. All the others, when I questioned them closely, confined themselves to lights, and particularly a glow of lights, red, yellow, and green lights. I did check this with specialists in the field, and they tell me that it is characteristic of swamps to, because of the rotting vegetation, to develop quite a bit of marsh gas. And this marsh gas is of various kinds. It is CH4 methane and H2S, and it is also CH3 phosphine, and also a very important component, P2H4, which is an impurity which ignites spontaneously in air. And this can ignite all the other marsh gas. Now, as I said in my release, I can't prove that this is the case in a court of law or anything like that, but it seems to me a very likely explanation.
Law officers and residents of the area had at one time or another seen the effects the doctor was talking about, but they pointed out that most of the sightings took place over solid ground, and a good many involved maneuvering, flashing lights, and a distinct shape. Dr. Hynek's belief in marsh gases was not exactly welcomed by Ann Arbor Sheriff Douglas Harvey, who had some interesting things to tell me.
Because if he's going to say it's marsh gases, I'll tell you now, in all due respect to Professor Hynek, he's off wet. I think this is a flowered-up deal, because last night he was in my office, and this is what my statement will contain, and at 11 o'clock, he had no statement whatsoever to make. He told me he had no idea what it was, but he said the Pentagon said that he had to make a statement tomorrow. He said, I don't know what I'm going to say.
I see.
So overnight, he comes up with this theory.
And Mr. Richard Hall, Assistant Director of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, was equally opposed to the marsh gas theory.
We have a very authoritative statement from a definitive work on the subject of visual phenomena, a book by Minert, Light and the Nature of Light and Color in the Open Air. This describes so-called will-o'-the-wisp, which is the visual part of swamp gas when it ignites in some manner that is not understood by science. And it gives a detailed description of the appearance of it and the chemical nature of it. And basically, it is nothing but flickering lights about the intensity of candle lights that rise a few inches or at most a few feet above a marshy area. If there is a breeze, it might drift around just a little bit. But it does not take geometrical shapes. It does not fly around across the sky or fly in formations, as many of these Michigan reports have stated. The swamp gas explanation by Dr. Hynek was applied only to two out of dozens of cases. We have several dozen reports from deputy sheriffs up there.
The day before the official explanation, according to William Van Horn, Hillsdale County Civil Defense Director, a train crew reported a UFO pacing their train for 7 miles. And Van Horn and 10 other witnesses watched the UFO through binoculars at an estimated height of 18,000 feet. Radar at the Willow Run station reportedly confirmed the sighting. What about the Michigan sightings as a whole? Interesting as they are, just how do they stack up against others? I asked Dr. Hynek.
Isn't it true, Doctor, that although the Michigan sightings did receive a great deal of publicity, there was nothing particularly unusual about them as far as sightings go?
Yeah, this is correct. I would say that if somebody wanted to pick some exciting sightings, they could have picked much better ones than that.
The controversy that billowed and swirled around the Michigan affair is not a new one. On countless other occasions, the Air Force as a whole, and Project Blue Book in particular, has been accused of purposely distorting information on UFO reports, issuing cover-up explanations, and generally sweeping the subject under the rug, at least publicly. Controversy also raged in the aftermath of sightings over a four-state western area, when the Air Force explained the UFOs as actually being the planet Jupiter and four stars. Astronomers angrily reported that Jupiter and those particular stars were at that time visible only from the other side of the world. Robert Risser, director of the Oklahoma Science and Art Foundation Planetarium, was quoted as saying, "This is as far from the truth as you can get." Law enforcement officers in the states involved also expressed amazement at planets and stars that could travel the skies in diamond-shaped formations, alter their course, and be picked up on radar. An editorial in the Alameda, California Times-Star last August had some bitter words about Project Blue Book's investigation. After a rash of sightings through an eight-state area, the explanations all boiled down to weather balloons, comets, planets, and other familiar objects. The editorial said, and we quote, "Just how the Air Force was able to tell that the hundreds of reports of UFOs from an area about as large as free Europe were faulty, and especially how they were able to do it within 24 hours of the time the reports came in, must rank as one of the most remarkable examples of lightning-like mass diagnosis of all time," unquote. What about the charge so frequently leveled at the Air Force? Are they really withholding information? One man who should know is former Major Dewey Fournette, Jr., United States Air Force retired. Mr. Fournette was the Air Force headquarters monitor of Project Blue Book for several years. He prepared analyses of UFO data for the Air Force and served as liaison officer between the Dayton Project and the Pentagon. I asked Major Fournette if he thought the men in blue were living up to their responsibility in the UFO investigation.
The Air Force is doing somewhat of a disservice by being overly paternalistic, by releasing only the information that they feel will avoid panic among the public. I've already just gone all along with them. They should step up the investigation. I don't think they've ever given it the attention that they should.
A concurring opinion was recently given by the Christian Science Monitor in an editorial in which the distinguished newspaper called for a thorough look at the UFO mystery. During the height of the Michigan affair, Representative Gerald Ford had issued a demand for a congressional investigation into the entire problem. Hearings on Ford's demands were held and were quickly ended. Secretary to the Air Force, Dr. Harold Brown, told why.
We have not been hiding anything. The investigations have been made public. The explanations of those where there is a clear explanation have been made public. In those cases where for lack of data or lack of a convincing hypothesis, the sighting has been kept in the unidentified category, we've been perfectly willing to say that, too.
Although Dr. Brown professed that the official policy is not one of withholding information, it is a matter of record that Air Force Regulation 200-2 states plainly that details of a sighting may be released only if positively identified as a familiar or known object. And paragraph 11 restricts Air Force personnel from publicly discussing UFOs. And the Joint Chiefs of Staff directive, known as JANAP 146, states that unauthorized transmission or revelation of the contents of sightings reports by military or civilian aircraft crews under certain conditions in any manner is prohibited. Major Donald Kehoe, director of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, had this to say about restricting information.
Well, that shows that they are withholding it because they don't allow anybody to talk unless they go through headquarters. No one except base commanders can explain objects if they're absolutely identified as something conventional. Otherwise, what they do is just put out general statements. statements except when they're forced to comment on something specific. So, and there have been other cases we know we can prove that they have put out a statement which was false, a false answer, and then have had to retract it. They did that in the extra case and the deputy sheriff's case in Texas, and there have been others where they put out an answer and then took it back, tried another one, and then took it back and tried a third one. So that is, I would say, that proves withholding right away when they are giving false answers. They are withholding the fact that these are unknown, but it goes beyond that, too. There are many, many things which they're keeping back.
I asked Walter Webb, chief lecturer in astronomy at Charles Hayden Planetarium in Boston, what he thought of the collapse of the congressional probe.
Entirely expected, as far as I'm concerned. They were just listening to the Air Force side of it, so you couldn't really expect anything new. But it's kind of funny, Gerald Ford was pressing for an investigation. Finally, he convinced the Senate Armed Services Committee to hold preliminary hearings just to see if an Air Force investigation was necessary. And so what happened? They call in just the Air Force side, and they reassured the congressman that everything was all right, and they were going to conduct their own probe to the unknowns, and the chairman of the subcommittee said, well, that's fine with us. So that was it.
If there's nothing to it, it seems that it's strange that the Air Force is so strongly opposed to congressional hearings.
Well, they've done their best over the past years to knock it down.
While the attention of the press was on Michigan, the rest of the country and the world was also having its share of reports of UFOs. In Ringwood, New Jersey, on March 11th, the mother superior of a convent saw a bright UFO over abandoned mines. She reported that a distant light flashed as if signaling. In Key West, Florida, March 23rd, there were many reports of several disc-shaped UFOs with lights flickering around their rims, streaking over the city, stopping, and then flying away. On the same date in Trinidad, Colorado, two shiny oval objects were sighted flying over a mountain ridge. And in Columbus, Georgia, on March 28th, two airport control towers reported a glowing oblong object that was seen visually and tracked on radar, maneuvering high in the sky. Police officer Irby, who was also a witness, told me,
"I seen it Sunday morning and also this morning over Columbus."
Same thing.
That's right.
Is this over that Army restricted area?
It was mostly over toward the Lawson Field Air Force Base, over Fort Benning.
Now, I understand that two airport control tower officers also reported this.
That's correct. One of them was the tower control officer at the Muskogee County Airport. And the other one was at the Lawson Field Air Force Tower.
Closer to home, radio operator Peter Gagliardis at Tweed New Haven Airport watched a UFO from the roof of the airport with binoculars after receiving dozens of calls about it on March 30th. He told me,
"Well, he watched it for about 3 or 4 minutes and called the East Haven police. They went down and they affirmed they had seen it. It was just hovering there, and I know it was an airplane. Couldn't possibly be an airplane. An airplane, the lights go on, one light goes on and one goes off, you know, in a snapping motion. This was two lights that were going on simultaneously, and they weren't going on in a snapping motion. They were sort of going from bright to dim, 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 and then brighten up again, you know, very slowly."
Sightings were also reported in New Hampshire, Maine, Chelmsford, Massachusetts, and in several western states. Many of these cases are obviously due to natural phenomenon, to fraud, to mistaken identity of familiar objects, and so on. But in many more cases, even a once-over-nightly explanation is never given, leaving the public in somewhat of a state of confusion. Mr. George Early is president of the Connecticut chapter of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena and an administrative engineer with a major aerospace firm here in the state. I asked him why the delay and, in some cases, the absence of reports.
The Air Force is often quite slow to get into the field and they often quit once they have ascertained to the best of their feelings that the object is not a threat to the United States. I think much more could be done. There have been a number of cases where the Air Force people have seemingly tried to slough off sightings, have tried to say that the witnesses were not competent and really not take an interest in them. And I don't think that this is a good thing to do from a objective scientific viewpoint. The increase in sightings and the increase in public attention, serious articles like those in Look, the Saturday Review, Life magazine, television programs are forcing a greater public awareness upon the Air Force. And they're not going to be able to, shall we say, get away with some of their less scientific and more casual approaches to the subject.
One of the major problems in investigation seems to be the fact that many observers are reluctant to report a sighting for fear of ridicule. And quite often, months and even years go by before information reaches investigative agencies. Well-known people are not immune to this type of reluctance, as in the case of Arthur Godfrey, famous television and radio personality. Mr. Godfrey recently disclosed on his network radio show an encounter he had with a UFO several years ago. Godfrey is an accomplished pilot, and the sighting took place as he was flying his private plane from New York to Washington. Near Philadelphia, Godfrey and his co-pilot radioed the Federal Aviation Agency tower in the city and reported a near brush with a brilliantly lighted object. The tower confirmed that there was no air traffic scheduled near the area at the time. Godfrey reported that the object paced his plane off his right wing, circled the aircraft, and came up on the left. He said he put his plane through several evasive maneuvers, but the UFO followed closely no matter what he did. It was a few minutes later that the object veered off and disappeared in the distance. Godfrey, a reliable pilot with everything from propeller planes to Air Force jet flights behind him, is a colonel in the Air Force Reserve. Another case that did not come to public attention immediately originated in northern Michigan. This one was last summer. According to United Press International, the Air Force radar base at Keweenaw Peninsula reported solid radar contact with 7 to 10 unidentified objects moving in V formation over Lake Superior. They reportedly were heading northwest at about 9,000 miles an hour at altitudes of from 5,000 to 17,000 feet. About the same time, jet interceptors gave chase to 7 unidentified objects over Duluth, but were easily outdistanced. Last June, during the flight of astronauts James McDivitt and Edward White in their Gemini spacecraft, McDivitt reported seeing an object with big arms relatively near the Gemini ship. Pictures were taken, and the first explanation was that astronaut McDivitt had actually seen America's Pegasus satellite about 10 miles away in a similar orbit. But the space detection and tracking system showed the Gemini 4 and the Pegasus were 1,200 miles apart at the time of the sightings. That explanation was dropped. Within 24 hours, back it came, with a supplementary explanation that the first radar fixes were imprecise, to the tune of 1,200 miles. Experts pointed out that this was a glaring error for a tracking system that boasts of being able to pinpoint the location of all Earth-launched satellites at any time. On February 11th of this year, a UFO described as having a dome-shaped top was spotted over Skowhegan, Maine, and was tracked by the radar of Dow Air Force Base in Bangor. Two Skowhegan policemen turned in the first report, which was closely followed by that of a motorist. The Skowhegan Police Department record and the Federal Aviation Station at Augusta confirmed the radar tracking of an object making tight turns at low altitude. Dow Air Force Base later publicly explained the sightings as ground clutter, probably weather. Where can the line be drawn on explanations of UFOs as familiar objects or aircraft in the top secret category? I asked Congressman Craig Hausner, former Atomic Energy Commission counsel, about his outlook on unidentified flying objects and on some of the more common explanations.
I neither believe nor disbelieve in them. As a matter of fact, I think that it's quite possible that these are something. Actually, since Ezekiel had his encounter with a flying saucer back in the Old Testament days, people have been seeing this kind of phenomena. So we can rule out the fact that it's nothing. I think we can also rule out the fact that it could be a hoax. There just aren't that many hoaxers over that many centuries. Possibly, too, we should rule out the fact that these phenomena are hallucinations. There's been no psychiatric explanation for anything of that nature, and these sightings have been too persistent to lead us to believe that it's in the hallucination category. I think the recurrence of these things has been so frequent and over such a long period of time that we must attribute them to something that does in fact exist. But it's come time now to have responsible people talk about it.
On the subject of top-secret American or Russian aircraft, other experts point out that experimental models are never built on a massive scale for obvious reasons. And if UFOs were explainable in this way, it would mean a tremendous fleet of experimental craft has been in operation for nearly 25 years, a highly unlikely possibility. Dr. J. Allen Hynek, the Air Force consultant on UFO investigation, has said ridicule is not part of the scientific method. Yet ridicule still plays a great part in the perpetual drama of unidentified flying objects. Many newspapers and other communications media have a field day every so often with what they feel is a particular time of year when psychological seasonal effects produce UFOs of greater intensity. I asked Dr. Hynek about this.
You hear a lot these days in some of the editorials that have been written in newspapers about the so-called silly season of flying saucers. Now, it seems to me that actually, in reality, the press themselves are really responsible for this so-called silly season, since the sightings really go on all year round and from all over the world.
Yes, the sightings go all year round, and in the past, the waves of sightings have generally come in July and when lots of people are outside.
Actually, as far as real concentrations of sightings go, there are relatively few.
That's correct.
Another popular misconception is that there has not been a single physical corroboration, photographically or otherwise. The Air Force denies that it has in its possession any photographs of UFOs, either still or movies. Major Donald Kehoe, director of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, says not so. And several witnesses to sightings have told of being shown an Air Force file of over 300 photographs so they could pick out the one that most closely resembled what they had seen. And it is a fact that the Dayton Project has at least three, and quite probably more, motion pictures which have never been made public. Mr. Richard Hall, assistant director of NICAP, told me...
These films were submitted to the Air Force and kept secret for many years and were revealed to the public by Major Kehoe. Their existence was denied repeatedly, but time has proven out the correctness of Major Kehoe's reporting. Both were analyzed by the best laboratories in existence at that time, including the Anacostia Naval Photographic Laboratory nearby in Washington, and the Air Force photographic people at Wright-Patterson, and they could not explain the objects. These films were also analyzed by Dr. Robert M.L. Baker, Jr., who is an astrophysicist. And we have a copy of his detailed analysis report. He did a photogrammetric study studying the pattern of motion of the objects, and he too could not account for these objects in any conventional terms. Later on, the public relations people in the Pentagon issued a flat statement that the Utah film in particular, Tremont in Utah, had been clearly identified as seagulls. And this just is totally unfounded.
And Major Dewey Fournette, the former liaison officer between the Dayton Project and the Pentagon, has confirmed the Air Force possession of the films and is on record as refuting the seagull explanation in the Tremonton movies. In Beaver County, Pennsylvania, last August, the son of a professional photographer for the Air National Guard took two pictures of a UFO that was reported by many persons in the area. James Lucci turned over the negatives for analysis to the Beaver County Times, a newspaper of considerable reputation, which confirmed their authenticity. Reporter Thomas Schley, who investigated the incident, gave me the story.
It was, I think around 11 o'clock at night, this boy and a couple of his friends, his name is Jim Lucci, they had a camera set up. He was shooting time explosions of the moon. He showed us both negatives. We could take both negatives and lay one on top of the other. And we could line up the two tree lines from each negative. And also the moon image. On one, the image that he photographed was down to the, we'll say the lower left. And in the second photograph, it had moved much closer. It would, of course, then be higher on the negative, and it was clear over to the right side of the moon image. And it's the picture that was in the magazine. All of our people were firmly convinced. They couldn't see a thing wrong with them. To me, the photograph, two photographs, especially when you view them together, rather impressive evidence.
Walter Webb of the Charles Hayden Planetarium in Boston added his approval.
That's quite a convincing photograph. That Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania one is a good one.
The Air Force, interestingly enough, has not yet released a public statement, but the Beaver County Times called the Blue Book investigators' attitude elusive and mysterious, and added that one spokesman described the official position by answering a request for information by saying, "My mouth is zippered." In California last August, Highway Inspector Rex Heflin took three pictures of a UFO near San Diego. The Air Force called the photos a hoax and said the object shown was a small disc that had been thrown in the air by Heflin or someone helping him. Heflin's supervisor vouched for his integrity, as did other reliable sources. And NICAP carried on an intensive investigation headed by Dr. Leslie Kyburn of Los Angeles with North American aviation engineer John R. Gray. Analysis of the pictures shed new light on the affair. Ralph Rankow of New York City, photographic expert, called the Air Force explanation impossible. Other pictures and color films of UFOs have also been thoroughly analyzed, not only in this country, but in many foreign nations as well. One controversial physical effect of UFOs is the much-debated electromagnetic phenomenon. Exactly what is it? What is its effect? I asked George Early, president of the Connecticut chapter of NICAP.
Oh, there have been a number of instances by responsible witnesses where a UFO has passed relatively close, say 100, 200 feet away, and car engines have quit, the lights have gone out, the radios, in some cases radios, police radios in communication with the police station have gone out. The entire electrical system has simply failed for some reason. And then when the UFO moved some distance away, the electrical system was able to be generated again. The car was able to be started. And radio contact was again resumed. Anybody who has been plagued on their radio or their television by interference from a ham radio set or from a doctor's shortwave diathermy machine knows what happens when the normal shielding on this equipment breaks down.
Richard Hall, assistant director of the National Organization, had some further comments.
The latest cases we have of that type occurred in Long Island on March 30th, the evening of March 30th. There were a couple of
independent sightings. They might have been related, but we can't prove it. One of which involved a UFO that came down and passed over an automobile. The man did not see the object at first until he started experiencing motor trouble, stopped to investigate, and then saw the object. And also on the same evening, there was a case where a UFO was observed and the animals reacted very violently and were quite agitated as the UFO was present. And of course, this ties in exactly with the sightings in Exeter, New Hampshire on September 3rd, 1965, when exactly the same thing happened.
What about the famous Exeter, New Hampshire case? Is there solid evidence? What are the facts on the Captain Ryan airliner chase affair? The Killian case, the Far East chase, the disappearing jet over Lake Superior? Why hasn't an official investigative agency traced down reports of UFOs before and during the strangely frequent power blackouts of the past year? Have there been any landings solidly reported? How about foreign countries with UFO reports? And what are UFOs? And if real, where could they come from? Next week, we'll go after answers to these and many more questions. Among the voices you'll hear will be John Fuller, the man who spent more than a month investigating the Exeter, New Hampshire sightings, witnesses to the Wanacue, New Jersey sightings, Barney Hill, the man who may actually have been taken aboard a UFO, Dr. William Pickering of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California, Dr. Frank Salisbury of Colorado State University, and Walter Webb of the Charles Hayden Planetarium in Boston, with some interesting revelations about the Mariner 4 pictures of Mars, and many others. We know you'll find next Sunday night's installment interesting and provocative as we present part two of UFOs, The Mystery and the Challenge. This is Jim Nettleton. Site of some of the most dramatic reports of UFOs in recent years. Tonight, we'll speak with witnesses involved in the Exeter sightings, as well as many other similar cases, on part two of UFOs, The Mystery and the Challenge, on WDRC's Hot Seat. I'm Jim Nettleton. September 3rd, 1965. Norman Muscarello of Exeter, New Hampshire, was walking along Route 150 when a red-lighted object swooped down over trees nearby. He watched it while it hovered over a house and quietly left. Muscarello reported the object was about 80 or 90 feet long. Half an hour later, he arrived at the Exeter police station, and officers there said the young man was white and hardly able to talk. Officer Eugene Bertrand went back to the place of the sighting with Muscarello, because an hour before, Bertrand and another officer had found two women in a car on Route 101 who told them that a red-lighted object had followed them for 12 miles. The women were badly frightened. Although Bertrand had taken the women's story lightly at the time, when he and Muscarello reached the location of the young man's sighting, the affair took on deeper dimensions. They parked the police cruiser, and Officer Bertrand told me what happened.
A bright red object come up over the tree and started towards us. We got a hold of him and dragged him back into the cruiser. At this point, Officer Hunt showed up. I called in saying that I was going to be out of the cruiser, so he had started out and he showed up. and I turned to look back at it, and it turned and gone down towards the end of the field about 100 yards away, and we all three of us stood and watched it. It had no wings on it. It had bright lights around it, red lights. It did not give off a beam like many lights give off. It more of a glow like a neon sign. And there was no plane in the area that night. We just watched it head towards the coast, and it disappeared over the horizon. It made no noise. Now, the hunters and the animals around there apparently could hear some kind of a noise because they were really, the hunters were kicking the sides of the barn. Some people were seeing it before them, but they didn't say nothing about it. They were afraid people would laugh at them.
Bertrand reported that lights on the object glowed in series from side to side as if the object were spinning. Mr. John Fuller, respected journalist for the Saturday Review and other publications, spent more than a month thoroughly investigating the Exeter encounters. He underlined the reliability of the officers' reports.
The main thing was the very graphic and carefully described story that the two very reputable officers of the Exeter Police Department encountered. And the most impressive thing about it, I think, was the fact that it was at such a low altitude and so near that there could be no mistaking of this object as might be if it were a higher altitude sighting. This, to me, after careful research, indicated a very intense and dramatic encounter.
And Dr. J. Allen Hynek, Chief Air Force Consultant on UFOs, backed up Fuller and the worth of the sightings.
The Exeter affair, which seems to be a very interesting one.
Extremely interesting one. The investigation there is being handled very nicely by Mr. Fuller.
Later, other policemen also reported the object, and several nights later, Officer Bertrand and other police watched a similar object through binoculars.
I put them on this object, and I could make it out then. It looked like a football, about the size of a, just about the shape of a football, I should say, not the size, with red lights on it. I also observed green lights on it, and no wings, again, moving in from west to east towards the coast again.
The Air Force announced that Bertrand and the others had seen KC-97 tankers refueling in flight, even though the objects had hovered motionless and were seen from less than 300 feet away. Officer Bertrand was a veteran Air Force pilot with extensive experience in refueling. John Fuller told me...
He was experienced with all kinds of refueling on KC-97 tankers and on the ground. He knew every aircraft by sight and even by sound numbers. So he was fairly experienced and not one to be fooled.
Next, the Air Force tried calling the sightings marsh gas. Once again, Officer Bertrand wrote the Dayton Project. He finally received a reply from the Secretary to the Air Force, Dr. Harold Brown, saying that his sightings were indeed unexplained. But this was a private letter and not a public statement. Publicly, the sightings were explained. Dr. Harold Brown, incidentally, is the man we heard in last week's installment saying the Air Force is hiding nothing. In connection with this, Mr. Fuller told me...
The Portsmouth, New Hampshire Air Force, their hands were tied because of Air Force regulations, but off the record, I picked up an awful lot of material from other officers and pilots up there, scrambling just after the objects and clocking them on radar, and also the Coast Guard Navy personnel up there gave me a lot of off-the-record stuff, but again, the sources can't be revealed because it would get these fellows into trouble.
I asked Mr. Fuller his opinions both before and after the investigation.
I went up there thinking it was just one case because I was somewhat of a skeptic myself. Finally, it turned out that I could find people who had sighted these on an almost continuous basis. Intelligent and reliable people liability is identity authorities themselves. After really thorough research, I had to come to the conclusion that there was overwhelming evidence that they did exist, that they were impossible to reach by the most sophisticated military craft. And I have to reach the conclusion that the interplanetary theory is the one with the least holes in it.
Fuller has written a book on the Exeter affair called Incident at Exeter to be published in July. An interesting facet of UFO reports is indicated in still another New Hampshire sighting. Officer Bertrand again.
Another officer. He saw this object again come out of the sky. It come down over some high tension wires.
The power line connection crops up frequently lately. I asked Raymond Fowler, formerly with Air Force Intelligence and now head of the Massachusetts chapter of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, what the possibilities are.
My own theory is that in many cases where UFOs have been sighted in the vicinity of a blackout, that they are responsible in some way, but there is no physical proof. This is mere speculation. You have many, many instances, hundreds of reports from all over the world where UFOs have caused interference to automobile ignition systems, radios, and lights, and other electrical apparatus to malfunction.
The November 9th blackout in the Northeast was only one of many around the world at virtually the same time.
Well, there were blackouts throughout the world. Stockholm, Sweden, the same day, November 9th. San Salvador, November 9th. London, 15th November. Lima, Peru, 19th November. The Hague, 3rd December. El Paso, Texas, 3rd December. Again, Texas, 7th December. Buenos Aires, 26th December. Naples, all southern Italy, 8th January. Los Angeles, Southern California, 24th January. There were quite a few blackouts. Most of them, they couldn't explain.
Actually, there never has been a completely satisfactory explanation, even for the November 9th one.
No, there are all kinds of theories.
The many UFO reports before and during the blackouts could be coincidence, but most are reliable, and it is food for thought. New Hampshire has had numerous cases, including many handled by Pease Air Force Base. One of the most outstanding is that of Barney Hill and his wife. Their story was run in a front-page, seven-day series by the highly respected Boston Traveler last fall, much to their chagrin. In 1961, Mr. and Mrs. Hill spotted a UFO while driving. Hill got out of the car and watched the object through binoculars for several minutes, got back in the car, and then drove away. They reported their sighting. It attracted little attention. Last year, Jack Luttrell, a Boston reporter, dug out the details. The Hills refused to publicly tell all the story. Sometime after their experience, they underwent psychohypnosis under Dr. Benjamin Simon, a prominent Boston physician. Under hypnosis, according to Luttrell, the Hills revealed that they had apparently been taken aboard the UFO, questioned, and given a post-hypnotic suggestion to forget everything. The central figure in all this, Barney Hill, told me...
We have been handling this from a scientific point of view, that we were interested not in the publicity, but in the gathering of facts about UFOs. We did see a UFO. In 1964, we did willingly subject ourselves to hypnosis by a reputable physician. With the purpose of gathering more data about UFOs in the scientific way. Not until 1964 did we finally find a reputable psychiatrist to hypnotize us, because we did not want anyone to hypnotize us.
Mm-hmm.
We did not want anyone dealing in theatrics. We wanted someone who we felt would be objective about it. One, you might say, who would be conservative in his thinking about UFOs, so that he would not flavor what he would want to find into our
minds causing us to do this, but one who is really opposed.
And Jack Luttrell, the reporter who uncovered the story, told me...
I have also listened to 11 hours worth of tape that the psychohypnotist Dr. Simon here in Boston made while these people were in hypnotic trances. This is documented right down the line.
The Hills never denied the story, nor did they ever try to capitalize on its commercial value. They turned down network offers, movies, and authors, and as a result, a lot of money. And they still refuse to talk about the hypnosis sessions, as does Dr. Simon. More recently, strange methods of investigation by the Air Force appeared in Wallacue, New Jersey. Mr. Howard Ball, editor of the Patterson Evening News, spotted a maneuvering and hovering UFO in January near the Wallacue Reservoir. Reservoir police also spotted the object, as did the mayor of the town, the civil defense director, and several councilmen. Mr. Ball told me what he saw.
An object, very bright, maybe 11, 12 times brighter than an ordinary star, and coming out of the south-southeast, traveling towards the north-northwest. I observed it for 2 seconds, and I startled of it.
Sergeant Thompson of the Reservoir Police added to his story.
It was kind of flying in a sort of, well, I said a crazy way myself, because that's what it looks like. As it goes up and down, it'll make a square turn, in fact. It won't round out, it'll just come right straight down, and then boom, to the right, shoot back up. Down and well, it just keeps doing that, and then all of a sudden we'll start sailing a straight line and disappear.
Mr. Ball had reported his sighting to the Stewart Air Force Base. He told me of the strange series of events that took place.
He asked me what I thought it might be, and I said, well, if it's anything I've ever seen in my life, it might be a helicopter with a big strobe light on it. And then an hour or so later, I called them checking the story out, and they said, we've discovered that it's a helicopter with a big strobe light on. I inquired about the source of their information. They said it was me.
It was later confirmed that no helicopters had been in the area. Similar objects were later seen by many police officers. The helicopter explanation was used by the press initially, and although Project Blue Book never made an investigation, the sightings were publicly explained 2 days later as Venus and Jupiter. Last week in Ohio, two deputy sheriffs said, "We were closer than we ever want to be again." They were talking of an 86-mile pursuit from Ravenna, Ohio, across the Pennsylvania state line with a UFO. Dale Spahr and W.L. Neff followed the object at speeds between 80 and 103 miles an hour. They reported it was 40 feet wide and 18 feet high. They came within 200 or 300 feet of it on several occasions and reported that it had a definite shape. A classic example of strange explanations was issued by the Air Force yesterday when they said what the sheriff and Mr. Neff saw and chased was an artificial satellite and the planet Venus. Other experts told me this was impossible. They point out that a satellite would appear only as a distant body of light, and this was a nearby object. And under no circumstances could the satellite appear to be of the dimensions that the sheriff described. The satellite's velocity would be considerably higher. And if indeed the sheriff had then spotted Venus after the satellite had disappeared, why did he report that the object sped off and he lost it? The Air Force said last week it was awaiting 4 or 5 pictures to be processed before completing its evaluation. Only one was mentioned in their explanation, and that had already proven worthless. The others were ignored. In many sightings, radar plays an important part. Radar trackings are sometimes admitted, but more often denied. Richard Hall, assistant director of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, told me...
One of my brothers is NICAP advisor, and he has over 10 years' experience on radar systems, and I discovered recently that a great deal of his experience was on the very types of
jet fire control system that was involved in a number of the radar cases of the 1950s, namely the F-89 and F-94s. And he was quite impressed when he read the reports, particularly those in which the pilots locked onto UFOs with their radar and quite often also saw some object visually. And he stated quite firmly there just was no simple conventional explanation for this sort of thing. This lock-on system is not such that it can lock on to a temperature inversion or any nebulous object. It definitely implies something really solid there.
Even when radar trackings are confirmed visually, they are usually explained away. One favorite explanation was put forth by Captain Edward Ruppelt, former head of Project Blue Book, in his publication, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects. Ruppelt said that any objects entering our atmosphere would be picked up on our sophisticated radar, the same sophisticated radar that made a 1,200-mile error in tracking the Pegasus satellite that makes frequent omissions during mock bombing runs made by the Air Force and is subject to functional defects. Other experts say that of the thousands of meteors that enter our atmosphere every day, very few are ever noticed on radar. And it might be well to note that a new anti-radar device was discovered on the Soviet jet which recently crashed in West Berlin, which permitted the plane to evade detection in flight. And the thought comes to mind, if the Soviets can fool radar, who knows? And although the Air Force says it is releasing all UFO information and claims no radar trackings, no photographs, no physical evidence, Major Dewey Fournette, former Air Force headquarters monitor of Project Blue Book, thinks otherwise.
From the evidence that I see, certainly they are not releasing very much of it.
In 1956, one of the most controversial cases took place in New York State. An American Airlines passenger plane was en route from Albany to Syracuse on April 8th. Its pilot, Captain Raymond Ryan, and its first officer, William Neff, spotted a brilliant light some 2 miles from them. They watched while it changed course and maneuvered at about 800 to 1,000 miles an hour. The control tower confirmed the sighting of an orange-colored object. In the control tower at the time was an Air Force man and a CAA man. On orders from the tower, Ryan abandoned his next scheduled stop and followed the UFO. They went as far as Lake Superior before turning back to Syracuse. The pursuit, deviation and flight plan, elapsed time, all are in Captain Ryan's public testimony, but are strangely lacking in the official flight logs. This gave rise to speculation that the logs had been falsified. Richard Hall, assistant director of NICAP, told me...
Well, we do have a tape recording of the program, and with Captain Ryan and his first officer, Neff, describing exactly what we state, that they did go off course at the request of the Area Air Force Base and did pursue an unidentified object. And this later was completely denied by all concerned, except that Captain Ryan wasn't talking. The company denied it, and the Civil Aeronautics Board and FAA denied it later. But we have the documented proof of it.
Even though Ryan's testimony was a matter of record, the entire affair was denied, and Dr. Donald Menzel of Harvard University, in his book, concurred with the official explanation that the sightings had been Venus. Major Dewey Fournette, former Project Blue Book monitor, had this to say about Menzel and his connection with UFOs.
Whatever Dr. Menzel said, I take and cut them about 10 different pieces and throw away 100 of them. Man is not a scientist, in my opinion. Well, he's got a vendetta. He made his money with look in 1952, and he's been stuck with his approach to it ever since. That was his first publication, when he first explained all of these things. Before he wrote his book, it was in answer to Bob Ganay's article in Life, let's face it. Bob Ganay put this thing together, all the facts that he could gather. We gave Life access to our files, everything but the kind of confidential material. He researched it himself, and he put it together, and then his conclusion was in the form of a question. What are they? Look got into the act by accepting an offer from Menzel to come up with their answer to it. Menzel came over, and I talked to him for the better part of a day, and he talked to a number of other people in the Directorate of Intelligence. We offered him access to the same material that Bob Binet had, naturally. He saw fit to turn us down. He figured that he had enough of his own material, didn't complete his research, published his article in which he explained it away as refractions and reflections and such things as this. And this is where the temperature inversion first jumped into the picture feet first. But the way he did it, not a scientific approach. That's been his posture all along. He stands up and says, now don't challenge me. I know everything.
There are many similar cases of airliners, military, and private pilots report since World War II. We'll briefly outline two of the more notable examples. In 1953, Air Defense Command radar spotted a UFO over Lake Superior. An F-89 jet from Kinross Air Force Base was sent to intercept. Radar watched the two blips on the screens merge and then fade from view. No trace of the jet was ever found. The Air Force explained the UFO as a Canadian C-47 and said the jet had identified it, started back to base, and then disappeared. This did not agree with the radar tracking, and the Royal Canadian Air Force roundly denied having any record of such an encounter with an American plane. Coincidence, perhaps, is the fact that the Kinross case took place in nearly the same spot as the tracking of 10 UFOs by radar a few months ago near Keweenaw Peninsula. Equally well known is the Killian case. Captain Peter Killian of American Airlines and several other pilots reported UFOs over Pennsylvania in 1959 during a routine flight. The reports were confirmed by ground sightings. The Air Force first explained the sightings as Orion seen through broken clouds. There was no overcast that night. Then they changed the tune to KC-97 tankers refueling. Captain Killian told the Long Island Daily Press that he was familiar with KC-97s in both day and night operations, and he flatly rejected the explanation. Later, according to NICAP, the Air Force circulated an unsigned statement, allegedly from Captain Killian, saying that, and we quote, "Never having seen KC-97 tankers in operation at night, I am not aware of the lighting of the jet tanker." These are merely sparse details from many interesting reports of a similar nature. Radioactivity has also played a part in UFO sightings. In one typical case, a man reported that a UFO followed his car in Virginia, then landed in a field near the road. The Air Force teams went to the area and reported no trace of radioactivity. 2 weeks later, two engineers went back and reported considerable radioactivity. Major Donald Kehoe, director of NICAP, told me,
"These were two DuPont engineers, well qualified to operate Geiger counters. They went in there and they found the ground was highly radioactive. That is very, very good because nobody can say, well, I kept sat deep in there hoping to find it. I know anybody can accuse our scientist engineers of making false statements. These men are competent and one of them put the thing on the record with his name."
Time limits our discussion of foreign sightings. There have been hundreds from virtually every corner of the earth. Many landings have also been reported, but these are not as frequent and have not been as thoroughly investigated. One of the major problems in this area, and in most areas regarding UFOs, is lack of intensive, objective scientific investigation. Skeptics point out that no really concrete evidence has been gathered. While this is not entirely true by any means, it is a fact that very little effort by the majority of the scientific community has been made. Taking the entire subject a step further, what are the possibilities of life on neighboring planets or relatively near star systems? The planet Mars has long been at the center of the controversy. America's recent Mariner 4 expedition sent back photographs of the red planet and although they were generally disappointing, they did have their interesting parts. I asked Dr. William Pickering of the Jet Propulsion Labs in California, director of the project.
Would you say from, just from your experience, that the possibility of these canals could be ruled out, or is it still open to debate?
Well, I think it's open for debate on the grounds that those photographs only cover about 1% of the surface.
When the Mariner photos were first released, there were quite a few people that had said that the photographs rule out the possibility of life on Mars.
And the answer I have given to this frequently is that of the first 20,000 prior photographs of the Earth, there was only one which showed that there was life on Earth.
What about the famed canals? Dr. Frank Salisbury, well-known exobiologist of Colorado State University.
I guess it is true. I can see what I think are linear markings on some of the pictures. And Clyde Tombaugh published a paper, which I haven't yet come across, but I saw a report of it in the papers, in which he said that there, he saw a number of canals in places where he had seen them visually through the telescope. This one was pointed out by the people at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, too. I saw another one which overlaps two pictures, and consequently it's kind of a good one. I mean, it's a little easier to believe it when it's on two pictures. They're kind of marginal. And it's nice to be able to see them on two pictures so that you can feel pretty good about it. But there are some rather interesting linear markings. I'd say that they're probably on the order of 1 to 2 miles wide, although I suppose they could be narrower than that if they were very brilliant white or something like that.
Curiously, a mysterious UFO was reported near the Canberra, Australia tracking station when Mariner was taking its Mars pictures. Another nearby tracking station had difficulty receiving at the time. Our other nearby neighbor in space is Venus, about which startlingly new discoveries are being made. A man who has made a thorough study of Venus is Dr. Frank Strong of Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. I asked him if certain areas of Venus could support life as we know it.
Certainly, yes. We don't want to be definite, but we don't want the people who interpret the microwave temperatures as high surface temperatures everywhere to be quite as definite as they are either, because we're just at the beginning of understanding this business of Venus, and they're trying to put the lid on it, it would seem, and I think that our interpretation might appear to be a rather disturbing one, but it's not quite as disturbing as the jump to faith that they have indulged in.
And what about relatively near star systems? Walter Webb, chief lecturer in astronomy at Charles Hayden Planetarium in Boston.
Astronomically, what chances are there of life in relatively nearby star systems, and which ones might be involved?
There's a book out that you might want to read. It's called Habitable Planets for Man.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Rand Corporation study made several years ago. It's quite good. And they discuss the possibilities of some of the nearby stars similar to our own sun that might have planets going around them. And up to 10% of the stars in our neighborhood, when they say neighborhood, that means that goes out to 100 light years maybe, but up to 10% of them are like our own sun in size and age, temperature.
What about our nearest star system neighbors, Alpha Centauri?
The main star is the same type, practically the same type as our own. And so is the larger component of the pair. And Proxima itself is not. It's an M-type red star, red dwarf. So at least two of the three stars are very similar to the sun. And they could be that some of these dwarfs are even closer to us than Alpha Centauri.
Mr. George Early, president of the Connecticut chapter of NICAP, said in connection with this,
"The public has become better educated in the last 15 years to the idea that we are not necessarily the only life form in this entire galaxy. Publications by serious scientific authors, by respected science writers like Walter Sullivan of the New York Times have pointed out that it is very likely that we are not alone."
The possibilities are staggering. Time has of necessity limited our examination of the subject to mere fragments, but the substance is there. Suffice it to say, there are countless other cases, contradictions, and volumes of controversy. We have just scratched the surface, but we've tried to give a general picture of a most complicated and often misunderstood drama. We wish to thank the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, 1536 Connecticut Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., for giving us permission to use its extensive files on UFOs and related material. We highly recommend that interested persons contact NICAP for more information. We also recommend contacting Project Blue Book, based at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Dayton, Ohio, for the official side of the story. We leave the conclusions to you, but bear in mind that today's fact is often tomorrow's fiction, and vice versa. It was just 25 years ago, when the atom bomb was being developed, that Admiral William Leahy, former chief of staff, said, "This is the most foolish thing we've ever done. It will never go off, and I speak as an expert on explosives." And at the turn of the century, Rear Admiral George Melville, chief engineer for the Navy, said, "Attempts to fly heavier-than-air vehicles are absurd." We have come far, but man's knowledge can never be complete. This is Jim Nettleton. Good night.